A few years ago, the BYU political scientists Kelly Patterson and Christopher Karpowitz started seeing something in American culture. It was this surge of individualism. But they noticed it was a particular kind of individualism, not the rugged type that characterized the American colonists who wanted to break free from Britain. This was different. They noticed people had started questioning the authority of traditional institutions, started seeing government and science and religion as being in competition with their own sense of self. And it seemed like more and more people believed the only opinion that mattered was their own. The only authority to trust is yourself. And it made them wonder, what does that attitude mean for the good of the community? There were plenty of examples where this came up. Christopher Karpowitz told us one that came from Texas.
We want to get to that disaster in Texas.
We certainly do.
In February of 2021, the state of Texas experienced a really devastating ice and snowstorm.
And some 7 million people under orders to boil their water before using a pipe's freezing, bursting.
One that existing infrastructure wasn't really prepared for. It caused widespread power outages. It stranded people without access to heat, to clean water, to other things that we take for granted.
Absolutely, Michael, good morning. We had intended to show you the ice that has formed on the side of this building, and you can see it there, and it's all gone all the way down, covering the landscaping there.
Typically, these moments of crisis are moments when communities come together and work together to solve the problem collectively, or at least to respond to it. But what was unusual about this particular episode in Colorado City, Texas, was the mayor's response. Tim Boyd is his name, and his message to the city was not that we need to come together and work together and government will help. It was, you're on your own.
The mayor of Colorado City is finding himself in hot water tonight. This is a screenshot of a Facebook post that's making the rounds online. The post appears to show a long rant about the power outages from Tim Boyd, the mayor of Colorado City. It says, in part, the city, county, along with power providers, owes you nothing. And, quote, only the strong will survive, the weak will perish, end quote.
I mean, that's sort of a shocking statement from a mayor at a time of crisis. You know, no one owes you anything.
But he did follow up with another Facebook post saying he won't deny anything he said in this original post.
That struck us as being emblematic of a certain approach to our communities and our social and political lives together. You are on your own, and in fact, it's weakness or problematic to try to rely on someone else or to expect other institutions or organizations to be of assistance. Instead, the only thing you could or should rely on is you. Your only duty as a member of a free society is to care for yourself. That is the only good that matters in the end, according to this line of thinking. We wanted to try to name it and identify it. And the term we've come up with is moral individualism. Where does this come from? What do we make of it when individual interest seems to override every other value? When the good is seen solely in individual terms? What does it mean when we decide that we don't have obligations to each other?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this brand of individualism Kelly Patterson and Christopher Karpowitz have been exploring. They've gone into the field. They've conducted surveys. They've written an academic article. They have a book coming. You can find moral individualism everywhere, of course. They even saw it in their own classrooms at BYU. We'll hear from Christopher Karpowitz first.
We have been thinking about this for a long time, and I think we didn't really have a name for it when we started. We were trying to put our finger on something that we were seeing in the social and political world around us that we saw with our students. Hmm. Kelly and I co-teach a big intro-level course at BYU, and we saw this sort of inclination in our students in terms of how they wrote about certain political issues. But then we started looking around us and saw it really all over the place. And we noticed that political scientists didn't really have a word for it or hadn't conceptualized it in this way. I mean, political scientists and political philosophers have been talking about individualism for a long time, but
not this brand that you were saying.
Not quite in the way that we were seeing it.
Wait, what were you seeing? So what exactly was it that you were noticing?
Well, this larger notion of self-authorization where our students, and in everyday interactions with them, you'd say, well, is that the right answer to the question? And they would say, well, yeah, that's my answer, so it's right. And that always, as a faculty member, makes you your head tilt a bit. But then you become curious about how they justify that.
Yeah.
So where did that come from, that notion that anything could be said about anything with regard to some of these political issues or social issues, and there was no way to adjudicate between what was correct or incorrect.
Because whatever I feel in my gut is it must be the right answer. It's the only answer that matters.
So you were seeing this idea of from students and then I guess from other places, people relying on their own authority. Like, okay, there may be an institution, there may be science or something else that could plug in here, but in the end, what really matters is what I think.
Right. That what matters when I'm making moral or political or social choices is what is my own view. And that view should not be constrained in any way. And in fact, that what other institutions, what other authorities might say about that is a constraint on the individual, right? And so this sense of moral autonomy, this sense of self-authorization being the most important kind of authorization is what we were seeing. And we weren't seeing political scientists talk about that in a way that reflected what we were seeing from our students.
Were you annoyed by it? Were you troubled by it? I know you looked at this in some level as scholars, dispassionate scholars, like, wow, that's interesting. Where is that coming from? We should look into that. But did you also think this could be a problem?
Yeah, and people have recognized that it has its problematic side. If you read a column from David Brooks or from Ross Douthat of the New York Times, they talk about these types of themes. And political theorists talk about these types of themes. They've been talking about them
forever.
For a long time.
Yeah. But what we didn't see was a connection between the way the political theorists talked about this self-authorization or this moral autonomy and various empirical indicators about the health or dynamics of the republic.
So I want to talk more about the way political scientists treated this. But let's back up a minute and talk a little bit more about that conflict, because between individual rights and the larger, the common good. This was something that I know you've both talked about. James Madison recognized early on in this country that conflict between the rights of citizens and what he called the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that. There's always been this sense that that is a conflict at play.
And whenever Madison talks about rights and liberties, he always balances it out with that phrase, permanent and aggregate interests of the community, which seems to mean that he recognized there was a tension there.
Hmm.
And
that's where you should end up,
and
is
that's,
there?
You have to figure out in the polity that you design how to both preserve these individual rights and liberties, but never lose sight that there may be such a thing as the permanent aggregate interests of the community.
Right. And Madison's worries about this emerged in the period after the Revolution and before the Constitution, the Constitutional Convention. And what he's looking at is the behavior of the states. Mm-hmm. And he sees the states and individuals within the state sort of pursuing their interests at the expense of these permanent and aggregate interests of the community. And his argument is not that we should not have individual interests. He thinks there's just no way around that. There's no way around the fact that we do have our individual interests and we have to recognize those. We can't, you know, we shouldn't abandon that. But he does think that we can find ways together of pursuing the permanent and aggregate interests of the community simultaneously. And it's that balance that he seeks and that we think is a healthy balance, and that there are problems that occur when you go too far in one direction or the other in a political society.
So you've got this big question being worked out early on in the creation of the country, and then this French thinker comes over and starts to look and see how they're working on it, Alexis de Tocqueville. What is he seeing, because you've talked about this as well, in his work, Democracy in America? What is he seeing in terms of the individualists at play trying to create a country?
Well, what he sees is a significant emphasis on the individual.
And which was foreign to him?
Yeah, coming from an aristocratic republic with a very long history steeped in a Catholic tradition, this was new.
Yeah.
Where so much time, energy, and effort being given over to the pleasures, the desires, the interests of the individual. And they came up with this word, individualism, to sort of explain or describe this new phenomenon.
The French did.
Yeah, in world history.
And he sees some advantages to it, right? So he sees that if there's a problem in some frontier community, you don't have to have a central authority come tell everybody what to do about it. Instead, you know, if a tree falls over the road, everybody just figures out how to solve that problem on their own. But he worries that if we go too far down this road of individualism, that people will withdraw from the community. They will withdraw from the things that make a community vibrant and meaningful as a community.
Yeah, he talks about the person withdrawing into themselves or into their own circle, because that's where happiness and desires will be fulfilled. And what he despairs for is the idea that at that point, the citizen leaves the rest of humanity and society to fend for itself or to care for itself, that the person has no real responsibility or care for what is going on beyond that tight-knit circle of friends and family.
Do you think that that's where the country is, if not already ended up, is headed? That is, groups of factions considering their own individual interests, detaching from the larger good of not just the institution of the government, but society. Do you think that's sort of where we are now on some level? That Tocqueville's concern, worry has come to pass?
He's very prescient.
Yeah. He was an extraordinary observer of American society in the early 19th century, and he saw strands that he worried about if they were to, you know, continue, strands of behavior and thought. And I think certainly we see today some of his worries made manifest. I think that's part of what we're trying to write about.
Because the question comes up, haven't we always been self-interested? Haven't we always been this way? Maybe we're distinct from the rest of the world, but hasn't the United States of America always been really keyed into the idea of individual autonomy and individualism? Or is this – haven't we always been this way is the question.
Those who organized the Republic had that sort of view. They believed in self-interest.
Yeah.
They believed that individuals would pursue their self-interest. But they thought self-interest was probably better than just straight-up passion. But the self-interest itself was not as good as virtue. Hmm. So the and Madison and others had written about the need for some virtue, and by that they meant simply caring for something outside of yourself. And self-interest, rightly understood, would be people recognizing that it's in their self-interest to care about others.
Hmm. So when have we then, as a country, sacrificed individual autonomy, individual rights for the common good? War comes to mind. But when have we seen that in the history of our country?
Yeah. I mean, war is the most prominent example, and certainly would have been one of the most prominent examples that founding generation would have cared about.
Yeah.
I mean, no, any nation worth its salt was a nation that had to be able to defend itself. and you couldn't take your place among the ranks of the important nations of the world. You just couldn't defend yourself. So that idea of national security is one of those areas in which you seek to believe that, or you find that, you know, virtue can indeed override selfish interests. But even that notion has changed a bit. We now have an all-volunteer army. And that all-volunteer army has trouble meeting its recruiting goals. And more, that all-volunteer army relies on appeals to the self. Right? Be all that you can be. That's one, right? Like, find your inner warrior.
An army of one.
An army of one.
That was one of their recent recruiting slogans. So those are appeals to individualism. They're appeals to making the most of yourself. And again, we don't think that in and of itself is a bad thing. We want people to, you know, pursue improvement in a variety of ways. But if that's the only appeal, right, then it becomes hard to see why one should do that. I can achieve self-actualization in a variety of ways, and I don't have to do that, you know, at risk of my life. And that's partly why I think the army sometimes has trouble and increasingly has trouble meeting its recruiting goals. So has there ever been like a golden age in which, you know, we've always
get into the common
goal? Yeah, we've always managed this perfectly. I don't think so. I think this has always been a tension in American history. But we can certainly find moments in American history in which individuals or groups say, well, yeah, it would be in our interest to do this other thing, but we're going to sacrifice on behalf of something bigger.
That's Christopher Karpowitz. He's co-director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. He's a professor of political science there. So is Kelly Patterson. He's also a senior scholar at the center. They're co-authors of the article Moral Individualism in Modern Politics. You can find a link to it on our webpage at radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I wanted to ask a little bit more about how the nature of the self has evolved over time. Let's start where we are now, or where I think you think we are now, which is this idea of us, the autonomous self, the moral individualist. And you quote in your writing an American political philosopher named John Rawls, who wrote this. He wrote that each person possesses an inviolability founded on justice, that even the welfare of society as a whole cannot override. Talk about what he's getting at there, because that seems like there is nothing more important than the notion of the self and justice for that one person. Even the larger interest of the society. Like he goes on to say that justice doesn't allow that the sacrifices imposed on a few can outweigh the larger sum of advantages enjoyed by the many. He's making absolutely a case, it sounds like anyway, for the individual, right?
He certainly sees the individual at the heart of society in an important way. I mean, Rawls more generally is very concerned about the question of justice and how do we get to a just society that both recognizes the value of the individual and pursues some common goal. But he thinks that at the heart there is a kernel of the self that is independent of other institutions and groups, and that you have to recognize that as a starting point.
Well, not just independent, but trumps those others. No?
At least in some respect.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's not necessarily an absolute.
That is a modern idea, yeah. Right? That's a very modern idea.
And when we say modern, we mean you compare it to perhaps Greek thought,
yeah,
or medieval thought,
yeah,
where – and medieval thought in many cases derives from what the Greeks are doing or did. But the idea in Greek thought was that you developed as an individual within a community, the language, the interactions, the responsibilities are what shaped the self.
And in fact, it's only within the community that you can fully become what you should become as a human being, right?
Which is to say you can proudly be a cog in a wheel of this thing, right? Whereas today it seems like the idea is, no, you're more than a cog. You're not just part of a big societal concept. You are a separate –
there's something you, that's you about you that is distinct from that.
Is
yeah,
that
that's
is
the
that,
modern idea.
Is that
that's
right?
That's the modern idea. Well, and this is what Rawls is doing. This is part of what we call the modern project. I mean, Rawls is trying to establish this notion of justice on reason, right? That we can logically come up with a notion of justice that doesn't require you mm-hmm. to think about all these other obligations and the ways in which you may have been constructed as a self.
It's funny, Dr. Karpowitz, you sort of laughed when I mentioned cog in a machine because it yeah. just seems like such a natural pejorative to
yeah,
imagine
exactly.
yourself as that. But isn't that what the great Greeks thought of, that is all the gears have to work together for this thing to work as a society?
Yeah. And Kelly mentioned the Puritans earlier. They come at it from a totally different perspective, but they would have said it differently. They would say, you're all part of the body of Christ, right? And everybody has a role to play. So don't be, you know, don't be sad if you happen to be the pancreas in the body of Christ. You know, just
You have your function.
You have your function. You should live up to that function and fulfill it joyfully, right?
But that's not where we are now, and I wonder – because especially – like you see this expressed in literature, in film, in television, this disdain for giving in to conformity, this sort of Stepford Wives sort of idea that suburban America has just this mind-numbing kind of complacency and conformity, and You want to be the black sheep. You want to be
the
flower.
Think of Melvina Reynolds' poem, you know, Little Boxes,
yes,
right?
Of
they
course.
All the little boxes on the hillside, and they all look the same. They all went to university, and they all come out just the same. And, you know, that's certainly something that people are – Kelly mentioned the 60s earlier. What are people reacting against in the 60s? Well, it's partly that sort of drive to conformity that we saw in the 50s and in the late 40s.
But it's this – your reaction, or like the way in which you describe the reaction, is that people just recoil at the thought of this, shows you just how deeply embedded this particular notion of the self is, and how it's just uncritically accepted. So that when, once again, when Chris and I would talk to students about it, they would back off a little bit and say, what's this person trying to do to me here?
Yeah, what are you asking me to do?
What are you asking me to do and think here? To give up on something that seems like it's just self-evident.
Individualism, it is all around us. It is the water we swim in as Americans. And so when you sort of pull back and say, well, okay, you know, what are the tensions here? What are the challenges that are involved in that? You know, often the reaction is, oh, well, don't question that. Don't question individualism, because that's just the unaccepted starting point.
Let's talk about this new measure you want to create or identify, this new measure of these individualist attitudes. Because what you write about is the idea of moral individualism, this brand that we've been talking about, hasn't really been examined or studied in political science, for example, or I imagine anywhere, maybe even in social science, but certainly you talk about political science.
Empirical political science.
They haven't really looked at it.
And there are lots of different notions of individualism out there, empirical notions of individualism in sociology, social psychology, certainly in economics, but nothing that we found got at the crux of this idea of a person's relationship to those institutions that could make claims on them.
When empirical political scientists have talked about individualism, they've mostly talked about it in economic terms. So what are the economic relationships that we have? What is the value of hard work? Does hard work pay off or not? Does individual effort pay off in some larger sense? Those are the kinds of questions that empirical political scientists have mostly asked when they've studied individualism. And we think those are important. Like, we don't think you can understand American society if you don't think about economic relationships in an important way. But we think they're leaving out this other way that philosophers and observers like Tocqueville have been noticing for a number of years. And so we were trying to create some measure, some way of getting at that more directly.
Let's talk about the survey. This gets us at the data that you've collected. Now, this was between 2018 and 2022. And I think it's important to say that you started collecting all of this before the pandemic, because that was such an acute example, I think, of how this idea of moral individualism has played out. We'll get to that in a second. But talk about – you start in 2018 – what are the questions you're wanting to explore? Let's get to the field. Right. And we're interested in this subject. All right, now how does it manifest? How does it work? What are the questions? Like, what are you interested in? How do you dig in there?
Well, we started even before 2018 with a series of pilot tests where we just went out and asked people, like, when you're making moral choices, what are the influences or the institutions or the other forces that you want to think about? And so we asked a bunch of open-ended questions both in the United States and in the UK. Hmm. And then we looked to see what people told us.
What's the question you're asking? You say, okay, if you have a really difficult decision to make, who do you go to?
Yeah.
A church leader.
A
professor, a friend, an intimate.
Do you look at
teachers,
science?
Coworkers, science.
Science, yes.
Yeah. And so we also ask the extent to which people think about politicians as political scientists, we had to ask that. But almost nobody
said. I was going to say, how many said that? Yes. How many consulted their senator or
very,
whatever?
Very, very few. Yes. Okay. Very few. So we stopped asking that question. But that so that sort of spade work, that early those early pilot studies allowed us to then come up with a kind of two-step measure. And the first thing we ask is, when you're making moral choices, who are the influences or the authorities that you seem to care about? Hmm. And that could be anything. And most people say their family. Hmm. Some people say friends or a trusted teacher. Some people say science or scientists. Other people say religion or religious leaders. And so those are kind of the most common responses that we receive. And then we take whatever they told us. It doesn't matter what they told us. And we sort of pipe it into a series of questions where we ask them things like, when it comes right down to it, is it more important what you think or what this other influence thinks? If you have to make a choice, which one of those two things are you going to follow?
Yeah. Under what conditions will you push back against this authority that provides moral guidance in your life?
So what you were asking is, if you have to choose between your own just deep sense of your gut,
yeah,
right, versus science, versus God, right, whatever, that's what you're trying to get at.
Yep.
So tell us what you found.
Well, it's interesting. This measure produces a distribution, right? Yeah. Some people really do want to follow their own self-authorized sense of right and wrong, and other people are more willing to lean on authorities or institutions. What we found is that you can find people who score high on our measure of moral individualism across the political spectrum. So you find them on the right, mm-hmm, and on the left, and you find people at the other end of the scale on both the right and the left.
You mean who don't just rely on their gut? They
right.
rely – okay.
Who take more seriously the advice and the counsel of those other influences, whatever they are, their family, religion, science, those sorts of things. There are differences between liberals and conservatives in the influences or the authorities that they mention. Hmm. So conservatives, unsurprisingly, are more likely to talk about religion, and liberals are more likely to talk about science. But once you have accounted for whatever the authority or institution is, they look pretty similar in the way they respond to lots of other questions.
What do you mean?
Well, that they're willing to push back, whether or not you say science, whether or not you say religion, there's or family or friends. There's a fairly large number of individuals who will say, boy, when push comes to shove – and I have to choose between what science is telling me or what religion is telling me or whatever, I'm going to do what I want.
Only I can decide what
and
is
only
wrong.
I can decide.
Right.
Right and wrong is a question for me in the end to adjudicate.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And then what we're interested in is as Kelly says, is the relationship between that measure of moral individualism and other attitudes and beliefs and practices and behaviors in our social and political world. So we're interested in, for example, does this measure tell us anything about how people interpret something like the American dream? Hmm. So we asked, for example, a ton of questions about the American dream.
Yeah, you did. I'm so interested in this. What were you getting at there?
Well, the American dream, I happen to teach a course on the American dream at BYU. And it's the interesting thing that about that is that it's a really broad idea and you can read a lot into it. And so what we found is that people who were high on the scale of moral individualism also saw the American dream in very individualist terms. The American dream is about me getting rich, or it's about me doing what I want to do, whatever that is. Whereas people on the other end of the spectrum had a really different understanding of the American dream. They thought it was about building strong communities or building something that benefits other people or helping my family, right? So those are substantively different
approaches
and attitudes. There's substantively different content of the American dream. And so what we find is that your attitude about individualism then has implications for how you view other parts of the social and political world.
Yeah. So all those other sorts of institutions and entities that we often see as part and parcel of the republic, families, like neighborhoods. The moral individualists are less likely to become caretakers for those.
Yeah.
Less likely to volunteer.
Less yeah. likely to volunteer. Less likely to participate in their community.
Do they vote?
They will vote. Yeah. They will vote, right?
Because they're asserting a right.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yes, okay. But they're not really interested in, you know, sort of getting out there and contributing to some community group or event. I mean, when we presented people with a whole host of volunteering opportunities and we said, you know, would you like to do any of these? Mm. And the moral individualists were way more likely than people at the other end of the scale to say, we don't want to do any of it. We just want to do our own thing, which is exactly what Tocqueville was talking about, right? He said, I'm worried that if we pursue this certain vision of individualism, people will withdraw to themselves and they won't invest in the community. And that's exactly what we saw in the volunteering results. And with respect to other sort of formative institutions in our social lives as well. Moral individualists are less likely to get married. When they do get married, they're more likely to divorce. Hmm. They're less likely to have children. Hmm.
They're more likely to say divorce is acceptable when it's not working out for me.
Yeah. They sort of see marital relations in very individualistic terms.
And once again, going back to both Tocqueville and to Madison, they were concerned that you would not have these resources upon which you could draw to help people understand that they had some sort of need to participate in the broader community, that's how you help take care of the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Somebody has to make a moral appeal to you. And if that moral appeal falls on deaf ears, then who takes up the slack?
And I think Madison really did believe that if you got representatives of different interests together in places like Congress, that they could talk to each other and that they could perceive, yes, we have differing interests, but we also seem to have some interests in common. And that he thought that kind of representation only happened if you bring these different interests together and they engage with each other in a really meaningful way. If you don't do that, if everybody is just sort of withdrawing to themselves, if they never invest in community groups, whether that's secular or religious, then you lose this opportunity to figure out what it is that we have in common with each other.
Christopher Karpowitz, he and Kelly Patterson are professors of political science at Brigham Young University. They're co-authors of an article called Moral Individualism in Modern Politics. You can find a link to it on our webpage. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. So who do you think has the reins over the discourse in popular and political culture today? The moral individualists or those speaking for the common good? What are you hearing expressed in terms of political philosophy? Because I do want to talk about the left and the right here. Who has the reins of discourse? The individualists or the people speaking for the common good?
I teach a class on the politics of individualism. And I do this for every lecture. I'll come up with an example called This Week in Individualism. And they're easy to find, the examples of a particular pop star who is now talking about what it means to be a good person. And it's all in the language of self-actualization. Or in politics, right, that everybody who participates in politics is corrupt or evil, and there's if they tell you that they care about the public good, then they're just
they're lying to you.
And so it seems to me that America, and this is what other countries have always observed about America, is that we are a deeply individualist culture.
Is individual just another word for selfish?
Not quite.
Not necessarily.
Or narcissist.
Ooh.
You're giving it more credit than being a complete pejorative.
Well, Tocqueville was pretty clear about saying that the individualism that he was observing wasn't necessarily egoistic, that people cared about their families.
Yeah.
Or they cared about their friends. It was just sort of broader society that they did not care about. Once again, I think it's more just the absence of a common language that you can draw upon to help people come into the public sphere and do something for a larger set of individuals beyond the narrow confines of your individual.
Where did the common language come from 100 years ago? That's not – I'm just guessing – I will just say a sermon?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, certainly – I mean, Kelly talked about the Puritan tradition before, and certainly that's one instance of it. And it's telling, I think, that today that word is kind of a pejorative. If we say, well, you're kind of puritanical, right? We see that as sort of – not as as a way of sort of working together to fulfill the needs of the community, but of being overly judgmental about the about the choices that somebody else might make.
But let's take the sermon part out then. Where else were they hearing voices? Was it at town meetings? Was it in literature? Was it philosophers that they read? Was it in poetry or civic lectures? I mean, where were they hearing that kind of language that gave them a sense of the common good before that wasn't related to a sermon that they may have heard at church, but somewhere else? Were there these institutions that were expressing these kinds of things more in the past?
Well, this is why George Washington was so important. He was the model, or supposed to be the model, for the way in which we thought about politics in this new republic. And because they had looked around and saw all these different states acting for their own benefit and politicians acting for their own benefit. And George Washington was to be the example of the person who modeled virtue for everybody else. And that has a certain appeal even today, but it's hard in a culture where, once again, you don't have the moral framework or the moral language to say that it really was a good thing that George Washington just stepped aside after two terms. Right?
There are things he could have done in his own interests that he chose not to do, right, for the good of the broader political system and for the constitutional system that was just getting off the ground.
And they always hoped for a modicum of virtue in the people. And they tried to create a system by which we would elect representatives who would bring that with them into office. And so it would be modeled for the citizenry and also practiced in the halls of government. But that's not the tradition anymore, it seems to me. This is the importance of Tocqueville coming during the Jacksonian era, is there's a fundamental shift in the way in which we think about the relationship between government and the people.
You've said that the pandemic threw these kinds of tensions into really sharp relief. Yeah. But let's talk about what difference this moral individualism made in a public health crisis that played out. Because it seems like in some ways – this is a strange way to put it – you lucked out in the sense that you had that as an experimental model to see how this idea that you had been working out before all of this – was going to play. All right, let's see.
What was good for social science was really horrible for humanity.
For sure.
Yeah,
for
talking about over a million deaths in the United States.
Yes.
But we certainly find that the pandemic clarifies these kinds of tensions in a really interesting way, right? Because what was happening and very early in the pandemic, we went into the field with a survey trying to ask people about these issues. And then we went back into the field in October and November of 2020 and then again in 2021 and 2022 to try to get a sense of how people were thinking about this at different stages in the pandemic. And we asked a lot of questions, so some hypothetical and then some we asked people to report their actual behavior. And what we found is that in every case, whether it was hypothetical questions or self-reports of their own behavior, people who scored high on moral individualism were simply less likely to sacrifice in ways that were conducive to the public good, or at least to what public health authorities were telling us was in the public good.
They weren't going to wear a mask.
They were less likely to wear masks. They were less likely to
get vaccinated.
To get vaccinated. I mean, and substantially less likely. Okay. So, moving from the bottom to the top of the moral individualism scale decreased your likelihood of reporting wearing a mask by 30 or 40%.
Wow.
Right? And the same thing for vaccinations, right? So it's just especially early in the pandemic. They didn't want to give up, their own individual interests on behalf of the common good. In this case, sort of the actual physical health of the community.
Once again, makes it harder to come up with a language that you can call upon than to pursue some sort of common purpose.
Because what we recur to is this language of individual liberty, right? So you shouldn't tell me to wear a mask because it's my choice, right? And that sees freedom as solely an individual pursuit. It's solely an individual thing. It's not something that we establish together, right? So there's another strand in American history. There is definitely that individualist strand. But as we've been talking about, there's this other strand that says, well, freedom really emerges because we establish together the right conditions for our development and for us to pursue a variety of different pursuits. And so when we give up on that language of freedom as a collective pursuit in addition to an individual pursuit, we are giving up a lot, and we saw that during the pandemic.
One of the things you write is that developing this new measure that we've been talking about, this new measure of this commitment to the autonomous self, you understanding what it is and now developing this measure to look at it, you say that can lead to what you say is this understanding of how individualism affects the conduct of political life. So say a little bit more about that, because I wonder if knowing how it works now and how it's expressed, how people talk about it, can you reverse engineer it? Or is it baked into people at this point? Or is that even anything that you're thinking about or interested in?
I'm really interested in trying to understand how people respond when you push back against the language of
when you call them out, you mean?
Not call them out so much as to say so.
That's, well, just – okay, not call them out. But that's my term.
Yeah,
but call out moral individualism. Say, hey, there's this thing. This is what it is.
Yes.
And it makes you not – it makes you hoard masks more than others. It makes you not inclined to volunteer.
Right.
Go to the soup kitchen. So what's the deal?
Yeah. And to say – got this moral justification for not doing or saying that you don't want to do certain things. Where does that come from? And what do you see of the advantages of holding on to that?
I think we've been really focused on trying to identify and measure this sense of moral autonomy. And I think the next step for us is to think hard about whether it's possible to get people to think beyond it. That won't just come from two political scientists.
No.
it would have to be a much larger effort. But it's an effort that I think we sorely need. I mean, if you think about the political discourse either in Washington, D.C. or, around the Thanksgiving table, it's a discourse that's in trouble in a variety of ways. And that's partly – it's not entirely, but it's partly because we've lost a way of talking together about what we have in common and about the way in which freedom isn't just you doing whatever you want to do, but it is partly about us creating together the conditions under which everybody can – do a little better.
It's Christopher Karpowitz, along with Kelly Patterson. They're professors of political science and scholars with the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at BYU. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is Carrie Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.